Home. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. With less than a month to go until Election Day, President Obama and Mitt Romney are reaching out to the middle class. It's all about the middle class. But what aren't we hearing about the middle class? Award-winning investigative journalists Donald Bartlett and James Steele say the middle class is in crisis. Since 1980, a series of policies and business strategies specifically crafted to enrich a wealthy few at the expense of everyone else have made it possible to shift the burden of taxes to the middle class, send hundreds of thousands of jobs overseas, and eliminate more than 85,000 pension plans. So, will tonight's presidential debate focus on these very important issues? It's a town hall style debate with questions about U.S. foreign policy and domestic issues. What foreign policy changes would you like to see to improve the economy? Donald Bartlett and James Steele have worked together for more than four decades. They are the first journalists to win both the Pulitzer Prize for newspaper work and its magazine equivalent for magazine reporting. They have written eight books together and are now contributing editors at Vanity Fair. They are the authors of the new book, The Betrayal of the American Dream. 20 years ago, they predicted what we're facing today in the book America, What Went Wrong, and they were pretty much called crazy for calling out what we are facing today. And Donald Bartlett and James Steele join us in studio. Hi, Donald and James. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you,
Rose.
Nice
to be here, Rose.
It's great to have you both in studio. We had such a great response when you were on last time around, and so we're happy to have you back. And before diving in and talking about all of these issues, I wanted to get your take, since you are longtime journalists, about the debates and this debate process. Time magazine has exposed what's really going on behind the scenes. Both sides, Democrats and Republicans, apparently are very concerned that tonight's moderator, Candy Crowley, will, oh no, ask follow-up questions from the 80 undecided voters that are going to be in the audience. So what do you think about this whole debate process?
Well, sadly, it's in keeping with the way this whole campaign has gone in many ways from both sides. I mean, it's just terribly scripted. And the problems come in when somebody goes off message or script falls down. So everybody is so obsessed about keeping everything exactly on a track that projects their image or does not detract from that image. So it's probably in keeping that there would be control in that. And it's sad because, I mean, the heart of a democracy has got to be free public discussion of what's going on. And the issues are quite complex. And I'm sure voters and people who are going to be at the town hall and others are going to be quite anxious to ask a whole range of things. So it's very sad that there isn't going to be that kind of follow-up, because that's what we need. I mean, in a million years, we're not going to get to all of these questions.
Right.
But that's the way you get to some of them. Because too often the politicians are asked a question, they don't give an answer, and the media person says, well, there you have it. And, of course, you don't have it, because there isn't that follow-up.
Donald, what are your thoughts?
Oh, it's identical. It's identical. It just... the news media has not distinguished itself well. Let's put it that way. Very, very poorly. And the problem now is most people get their news from TV news, which is the worst possible source for news. I don't know. I don't know what you do about it.
Well, so what questions would you both ask? Because so far, issues like poverty, homelessness, a trade, so many issues have not been asked.
Well, both candidates are talking about the middle class. And you've noticed in these discussions, for the most part, they're not even talking about the poor anymore.
Right.
Years ago, we at least in some of these debates would talk about the poor. And in part, that's because a lot of the middle class is slipping into that zone at this point, which is what our book's about. But rather than just talking about the middle class and how the middle class needs to be helped, we would love to see some real specifics, like how do you do that? I mean, what is the plan other than these glittering generalities? Obama's come a little closer to that on the tax stuff, we think, in the sense of what could be done there in terms of taxing folks at the top, which almost everybody agrees, except the very top, should be done. Study group after study group, polls indicate people would support a higher tax on folks. That would do something to help issues of inequality in this country, no doubt about that. But we really got to go beyond that, because we need to get this economy going. And then beyond getting the economy going, start building true middle-class ways of life again. It's not just, and we make the point in the book, what's happening right now is not just this recession and the aftermath of it nationally. Even when the unemployment rate comes down, we're still going to have stagnant wages, incomes going down. If you don't have a job, any job, of course, is better than no job, so you'd be happy to get that. But that's not going to solve what it's going to take for people to support their families and raise them in what would be a true middle-class lifestyle.
And it also just perpetuates what's going on now, because the new jobs do not pay what the old jobs did.
Right.
So this means you have a lower tax revenue, which means you're adding to the deficit further. And it's just a never-ending feeding process.
It's kind of amazing. I'm still surprised that this fact is rarely mentioned, that the majority of the jobs that have been created are low wage. They pay between $7.50 and $13.50 an hour. But you hardly hear this mentioned.
And that's why all of this rhetoric about job creation falls so flat. Because, yes, some jobs have been created in the past, but they're not paying. And when the book, almost everybody we have in the book is working. But very often, they're working at a job that earns less than the one they had before that, or it's a contract basis, may run out in 6 months, or their benefits, they have to pick up the cost of their benefits, or they have no benefits in some cases. One way or another, it's a reduced standard of living from what they used to have.
And, you know, for 40 years, we basically used tax data. But there's some now interesting Social Security statistics coming out, and they show that 50% of people earn less than $26,000 a year.
50%?
50%. You know, so this downward trajectory is not going to change unless somebody gets serious and does something.
Now,
and you see no evidence of that anywhere.
This is 50% of all working people, regardless of age.
Oh, exactly.
Okay. Right.
It's 50% of people who are having payroll taxes withheld from their paychecks. Now, you know, I know someone will say, well, there's a lot of kids in there. That's true, but not 50%.
Right.
I mean, this is what's so hypocritical about the 47% comment of Romney. Mm. I mean, an awful lot of those people may not be paying income taxes, but they are paying payroll taxes and Medicare taxes, not to even mention state and local taxes, which in some states, like California, can be quite high.
And 66% earn less than $40,000 a year. So, you know, if you're in San Francisco, lots of luck. $40,000 is not going to get you a...
Well, and these days I have a friend who just rented a new studio for $1,200 a month, and it's a tiny space.
Yeah, right.
And now, tonight's debate is going to be about foreign policy and domestic issues. And last time you were all on, we went through your book. We talked a lot about how the middle class have been hit hard by 40 years of these policies. We didn't spend too much time on foreign policy. And I'm wondering what you think about how foreign policy affects our domestic economic agenda. And I would love a moderator to ask this question, because the United States spends 58% of the total military dollars paid out by the world's top 10 military powers, which last year was about $1.2 trillion just in military funding alone.
Sure.
So can you talk about how foreign policy determines our economic agenda, James?
There's a couple of areas. One is so many jobs have been set offshore. And it's been in our interest in the past, we said, to try to encourage other countries to develop their economies, and we would accept some of their products. That's certainly been the good part of America, and a lot of people think that's a good idea. We don't dispute that general notion. But in many developed countries, as well as in developing countries like China, we haven't had a true free trade regimen. So we haven't had an equal playing field. And as a result of that, we let products in here. And this is a foreign policy thing as well as an economic policy, but at the same time do not insist on equal access to some of those countries. Plus, I mean, China in particular, the incentives, the subsidies that the national government, that the provincial governments provide to companies make it very difficult for some American companies to resist those temptations. And, you know, our point is, okay, go over there, do what you want, but then when that product comes back, it should have an appropriate tariff on it or tax on it that makes it in some way commensurate with the domestic market. And, of course, the minute you raise that point in this country, everybody goes crazy. You can't throw up walls around the country. We don't want protectionism. But because we have not been able to face that issue, we now have a cumulative $10 trillion in trade deficits over the last 35-plus years. None of our other developed country partners, trading partners, have those kinds of deficits. So that's one thing. The other issue you talk about on military, obviously if you would shift some of that money to domestic programs, and if we had done that over the last, who knows, 10-plus years, where would we be now? I mean, everybody wonders that, and there's the idea that you can just have all that money flowing to that and then not have an impact on your economy is ridiculous.
What would you add to that, Donald?
The only thing is there are a lot of simple solutions out there to deal with these problems, but nobody wants to do it. And one on this area would be very, it's very easy. You want to start a war wherever it is. And by starting a war, I mean you want to send U.S. troops to another country. You've got to have a way to pay for it before that first soldier leaves these shores. You've got to come up with a designated tax, which will remain in place until that adventure is ended. Don't hold your breath on that.
Rather than pass a tax cut like the Bush administration
right.
did.
Exactly.
And for the first time in history, we finance wars without paying for them. And, you know, we make the point with these deficit nuts out there now. I mean, where would we have been at the beginning of World War II if these guys had been in control of the government? The country, the U.S. is attacked, and they come in and say, military says we need 1,000 airplanes. And these guys would say, well, okay, we'll give you 75. I mean, there's a time to spend money, and that's the other part of what we suggest. We need, as a country, as a government, to spend more money right now because things are bad. We don't mean just, you know, this program or that program. Infuse it into infrastructure. Put it into other programs. It'll have a ripple effect because private industry is not investing in this country. They're investing in many places offshore, unfortunately.
And these are the most profitable years for corporations in American history. And if they aren't doing anything, it's criminal, period.
Well, because productivity is up.
Yeah, of course.
That's because everybody's working very hard. A speed up.
We're speaking with Donald Bartlett and James Steele, a veteran journalist who've worked together for more than four decades. 20 years ago, they predicted what we're facing today in their book, America, What Went Wrong? And a lot of people didn't take them seriously at the time. And they're out with a new book called The Betrayal of the American Dream. And they will be speaking tomorrow at the Marine Memorial Center, 609 Sutter. We believe it starts at 7, but we'll get that confirmed in just a minute. And we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Tonight's town hall debate, basically how it runs is there will be 80 unconfirmed voters in the audience, and they will be asking questions about foreign policy and domestic issues. There's a lot of controversy about whether Candy Crowley will be, quote, allowed to ask a follow-up. Apparently in interviews, she had said she wants to, but the debate commission says that Barack Obama and Mitt Romney do not want her to. So we'll see how that goes. We'll talk about that on Friday. What question would you ask tonight? And since it is about U.S. foreign policy and domestic issues, what are your thoughts about how U.S. foreign policy determines our economic agenda? And what changes would you like to see to U.S. foreign policy to improve what we're currently facing with the economy? And how do you think our economic policy drives U.S. foreign policy? And let's hear from Roger in San Francisco. Hi, Roger. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you, Rose. I'm going to throw a few numbers out to your audience. I don't want to bore them, but it's very important they understand this. It's about money leaving this country. It's about corporations using their systems to avoid American taxes. Cisco Systems, for instance, foreign cash, $41.7 billion. That's 89% of their total cash. Google, $25.7 billion in foreign cash. That's 48% of their total cash. Hewlett Packard, $8.1 billion. That's 100%. Of their total cash. eBay, 7.0%, 7 billion point zero. That's 88% of their total cash. The biggest one is Apple, foreign cash in billions, $74 billion. That's 67% of their total cash. Now, here's an interesting way they deal with this. Your audience say, well, why would they send their money overseas? Because they avoid the idea is to avoid paying our taxes.
Right.
And what they do, when they get that money over there, this is the most ingenious part of their money, they loan the money back to themselves. It's a scheme. Hewlett-Packard vice president talked about this. They loan the money back to their own companies from their foreign entities. That's how they get the money back. This, you know, I don't like using words like this, but this is almost treason. Those companies, if they kept that money in this country, it could create thousands of jobs. But they just sneak around and put their money overseas. Now, we have a presidential candidate who has money overseas in Swiss and Caribbean countries. He is avoiding cash, avoiding taxes. Now, is this fair? Is this right? Is this not a form of it's treason.
Well,
literally treason.
Thank you for calling in, Roger. And all told, we're talking about $1.24 trillion by the companies you mentioned, along with others like Pfizer. What are your thoughts on this, James, and how should this be dealt with?
Well, this is not a new issue, and he's absolutely right, his description of what's going on. And, in fact, we deal with some of this money up. In fact, some of the estimates put it up to $2 trillion is sitting in these various banks. And all these companies are crying like, oh, my gosh, we'd like to bring it back, but your tax rate is so high. If you just give us a little break, maybe put our rate down to 5% or something like that, we'll bring some of this back and create jobs. Well, there's a template out there about just this issue, because in 2004, almost the identical thing was going on, and Congress gave those companies the right to bring a lot of that money back with the understanding that they would be creating jobs. So companies repatriated about $312 billion at the time and avoided taxes of $3.3 billion as well on that. But the program was a complete sham. Rather than creating jobs, the 15 companies that brought back the most money actually cut 21,000 jobs. So even when Congress went along with this, then there's no follow-up to institute the kinds of penalties that they should have had because they didn't follow through the way they were supposed to.
It's very sad, but the fact of the matter is Congress will not crack down when it comes to the tax code, either on upper-income people or corporate America. They just will not do it. There isn't an ounce of integrity in Congress. You know, there's always a few people who will. But basically, they won't touch this. And it's just morally and ethically wrong.
Have you two interviewed members of Congress about these issues?
And we've actually talked to some who their heads are in sometimes the right place. But the fact of the matter is a lot of them will talk the talk about we've got to do something about this. We've got to bring it. But when push comes to shove, they won't do it. And you know, the problem here is that when this happened, there should have been enforcement mechanisms in place to make this very punitive on these companies. But, I mean, how can you possibly be granted something like this and rather than creating jobs, eliminate jobs? Totally.
The key critical word Jim used there is punitive. And that really is what needs to be done. And there is an easy way to do this. Okay, you want to keep the money over there based on last year's taxes? Fine. You lose all your deductions on this year's tax return. Every single, you can't deduct your payroll, nothing. You lose everything, which means, of course, their taxes would go through the roof. But that's the trade-off you're going to have to accept if you want to do this.
Your caller really highlights a very important point, and we make this point in the book. There is such a split between the domestic corporations, many of whom actually do pay a reasonably high tax rate, versus the multinationals, like the ones he just recited, whose tax rate to the U.S. is very, very low. And that's not fair either, because that penalizes the folks who are still doing business in this country.
And what about small businesses?
Well, they fall into that category.
Right.
Exactly. And they
tend to be lumped together.
Yes.
They do.
The candidates say they love small business.
Right.
But it's rare that there's a distinction made. And we did a show about small businesses about a month or so ago. And most people have no idea that most of us are employed by a small business
right.
averaging about 8 employees.
Right. And in some cases, paying high taxes.
Right.
And the other thing is, of course, a hedge fund is a small business. So figure it out.
What do you mean?
Hedge funds qualify, many of them qualify as small businesses.
How? How many employees are we talking?
Very few.
Oh, okay. So you might have a hedge fund business with 5 or 10 employees.
Yeah.
Or even maybe more than that. But unlike a GE that has 30 or 40,000. So, they can take advantage of that situation.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Roger. And let's go to our next caller, Ede in Berkeley. Hi, Ede.
Hi. Yeah, that caller was 100% right. Most companies, even Apple, it started with few guys, just very few guys. And as so is Google. As soon as they get wealth, as soon as they get the money, guess what? They jump overseas. No country in the world, Japan, Germany, or others, will allow their companies to do that at all. And we accept it gladly. And the Congress, as guilty as sin in it. But one reason I call is two things. First of all, I get really angry, even when Obama says it, austerity or entitlement. How can we be austere when the banks have ruined the economy in this country and companies like Apple and the rest of them? How can you be entitlement to Social Security when you pay for it all of your life? And if you're an employer like myself, a big business for quite a few years, I paid over $1 million in Social Security. How can you call it entitlement when my employees retire? It is just the American people really sold bill of goods. The only way to fix it right now is two things. Number one, we're going to have to go up their banks because the money's still there. It is still the richest country in the world. The money in the country did not leave. They just stole it. The second thing, we have to go up to the Congress and we have to say the emperor have no clothes and just totally. We may even have to do just one term. So you won't have to go act like prostitutes and get money from whoever, pay their way through the government.
Thank you for calling, Ede. I just want to make sure we get a response before break. Ede actually owns an electronics store in the East Bay. So
I see.
He's seen a lot of the changes in terms of jobs going overseas.
Sure. Well, just quickly, he's so right on the word entitlement. This is one that just gets the hair on the back of our necks up because this is something the conservative side has come up with, the idea of entitlements. Mm-hmm. The fact that people are paid into these funds most of their working life, they seem to ignore this. And one of the reasons everybody wants to cut the budget now, or at least these certain think tanks, the deficit talks, is in part because the money hasn't come into the Treasury the way it might otherwise have come in. I mean, there's $700 billion was added to the deficit in the last decade because of the tax cuts in the 2000 decade era. So he's absolutely right on that. And, of course, the banks haven't been fixed. Everybody knows that. And the idea that this country is overregulated, which is a comment that you hear from time to time, totally ridiculous. The lack of regulations, the free-flowing cowboy economics that let the banks do what they did and brought us to this particular juncture.
And all of the things that existed, like the credit default swaps, all of that, it's still in place. Mm. They didn't fix anything because basically, corporations at that level own Congress, and Congress serves at their pleasure.
We're speaking with longtime journalists Donald Bartlett and James Steele. They've worked together for more than four decades, and they've written 8 books together. 20 years ago, they wrote America, What Went Wrong, and they predicted what we're facing today. A lot of people called them crazy, and here we are. Today, they're out with a new book, The Betrayal of the American Dream. And we've got one line open, so if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. How does our economic policy drive U.S. foreign policy? We'll be back after this.
Your call in just a moment. The program is always better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send email questions or comments to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. And coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will continue our election coverage with a debate on Proposition 34, which would repeal the death penalty in California and replace it with life imprisonment without parole. Supporters of Prop 34 say it'll save the state money, while opponents say it's not fair to victims and their family members. Where do you stand on abolishing California's death penalty? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined once again by Donald Bartlett and James Steele. They've worked together for more than four decades. They're out with a new book called The Betrayal of the American Dream. And today we are talking about a wide range of economic issues and tying it to U.S. foreign policy, because tonight's presidential debate will be a town hall with questions about both U.S. foreign policy and domestic issues. And we've got full lines. We'll have one open in just a couple minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm on a little low energy after being out for a few days, so this is great that we have full lines. So much interest in this topic, and we're so glad that we have both of you back. So let's go back to calls, and thanks again, Ede, for calling in. Let's go to Drew in San Francisco. Hi, Drew. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Gentlemen, I definitely would like to connect the foreign policy and the domestic economic policy with my question. It's kind of interesting, the coincidence of the disappearance of a real embodiment of an alternate economic system in the form of the Soviet Union, you know, really beginning in the 80s as we saw it dissipate in its power and its ability to, you know, continue to exist, and then into the 90s. And then we saw a ramp up of the sort of economic policies that really, you know, transferred the wealth from the lower half, well, the lower 90% to the top 10%. And it's kind of interesting, if you look at history, really, you know, we lived in a feudal era until the time of Marx. And the thing that changed that feudal idea was the Industrial Revolution combined with Marxist kind of concepts that, you know, pushed for more of a distribution of wealth. But with the disappearance of the Soviet Union, do you think that the ruling classes of the world feel secure enough now to kind of return us to a modern feudalism? You know, where everybody works at Walmart, you know, or you, you know, the butler to Steve Jobs or one of his, you know, successors.
Hi, this
or
is
Sergey Brin or someone like that, you know, instead of having, you know, real jobs and real wealth for people in the lower 90%.
Well, the triumph of the of what we might call the economic elite in this country, at least just in the United States, has been actually going on really long before the fall of the Soviet Union. In fact, we trace this in the book. A lot of this stuff stems from the 70s into the 80s. And a lot of it coincided with the founding of some pretty sophisticated think tanks on the part of the right that began to spew out position papers that a lot of the mainstream media sometimes picked up as authentic, things like the minimum wage, raising that is evil, having government involved in any way in healthcare is evil, even though these people sometimes forget we've had Medicare since the 1960s. On down the line, there's a whole range of things that you see that. So the economic elite have been slowly consolidating their grip on policymaking in this country for quite a while now. What amazed us is that when we wrote America, What Went Wrong, back in 91 and 2, and which Rose referred to, and when a lot of people did criticize us, I'll tell you, it's inconceivable to us the things that have happened since then. Mm-hmm. I mean, we thought, they'd already gotten tax breaks. They'd already gotten a trade policy that was hampering down the middle class. They'd already deregulated some industries that were very destructive. I mean, how much further could they go? And the fact they could go a lot further, as we found out. They had put in tax increases or tax cuts for themselves that have been catastrophic for the deficit, that have created inequality in this country on a scale we haven't seen. I mean, some people say since the 20s, others say since the robber baron era in the 19th century. So all these things are going on before that. And some of these problems do exist in other nations, Western Europe as well, but not to the extent they do here. You see the governments of most of the prosperous Western European nations. You see the government of Japan still believes that government has a role in some very fundamental factors And by making investments in the country, and that's what you see in Japan, that's what you see in Germany, you help your society overall. And that's what we don't seem to believe in this country anymore.
I met a guy from Denmark recently who recently finished college. He said every college in Denmark is free. The government actually pays you about $1,000 a month to go to college. And I said, so now that you're working, how much do you make? And he said about $45,000. And how much are you taxed? 40%. And how do you feel about that? I'm fine. That was it.
Right, because he had no college debt and all the other things that the lucky graduates here have.
That's a common response, because we've asked that question to people from Scandinavian countries over the years. And they're all, what's wrong with this? I don't have to worry about my health care. My children are taken care of. They go to college. I don't mind paying taxes.
You know, it's interesting because I just read a report that came out of Texas, and it found that 70 to 80% of Texans would have their taxes raised if it meant better schools. And you see these studies on a regular basis.
Absolutely. You see, and at the federal level, there's a survey after survey that say most people would support a higher tax on wealthy people in this country, not even going down deeper like the one in Texas did. So people are, I think, willing to do that if they think they're going to get something in return. They have been, but a lot of the propaganda that comes out in these election campaigns is one of the most destructive things of all. It's not just a matter of buying the congressmen and senators. It's these ads that all these rich entities have that twist the issues, and sometimes people don't vote their own best interest.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Drew. Let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. I'm probably going to have to turn my radio down.
Yes, please.
There were two things that occurred to me while I was listening. One was Michael Peretti was once asked, what do the rich want in this country? And he said, they want it all. And the other one was that I'm sure your guests are familiar with a man called Smedley Butler, who was a Marine Corps high-ranking. He may have been the commandant of the Marine Corps. He was asked after he retired about his role in the Marine Corps, and he indicated, this is back in the 20s or 30s, he said, I served as a hitman for American corporations. Most people don't want to look at the E word in this country, that is empire. There is no way that you have hundreds of bases, military bases around the world, for any other reason other than to protect American interests, and that's corporate interests, around the world. And so people don't want to look at that. You know, one last thing. Your guest just mentioned something that was really phenomenal, that the American people would pay higher taxes if they thought that they would get something back for it. I'm beginning to think that even if an overwhelming majority of the American people wanted a more equitable society, I'm not sure they'd be able to get it.
That's a really good point, and I think he's right. I think he's right. Sad to say.
I mean, the way the system is structured now with the money, it's, you know, that's at the heart of the whole issue. And this isn't a new problem. It's gotten worse since the Citizens United verdict in the Supreme Court, in terms of we're seeing the kind of money flowing in now that's even greater than ever. But it goes back way before that. And that's another thing we need to examine in this country. I mean, do you really want to have a two-year-long election campaign? Or do you want to figure out some way to constrict that? Some people say we need a constitutional amendment to do that. We're not sure what the ultimate answer to that is, but the way we've been going seems to be increasingly tamping down the interests of the vast majority of Americans, and that's not what America's about. That's not what it used to strive for.
And Donald, when you said that that's just the way it is, sorry, a sad state, what do we do at that point?
You know, for as long as we've been writing about this, this is the first time we've ever heard people raise the question, is this solvable without violence? And when that time comes, if it turns to that, it will happen overnight. And people will say, well, how's this possible? And they're laying the groundwork for it. They don't understand it. They think they can continue to just put their foot on the necks of people continuously without paying a price for it.
It was interesting, the quotes. You know, we talked to a lot of people around the country for the book, and probably the vast majority of those are not even in the book, because that's just the nature of research. But some of the quotes are in the book, and one of the most amazing ones to us was of a woman who had two college degrees, who ran a 100-person department of a major international firm in Florida. And one day she found out the entire department was just being sent offshore. And I was talking to her about what other people in that department were doing, what the occupations they found, blah, blah, blah. Kind of get a feel for it. And at the end of the whole thing, I said, where do you think this country's headed? This is the most mild-mannered woman you can imagine, decent in every way. And at the end of that, she paused for a second. She said, if we keep going where we seem to be going, with an elite class and everybody else, isn't that what inspired the American Revolution? Will the lower class always put up with it? And whether she was talking, what she was talking about, violence or otherwise, who knows? But the point is, it goes to the heart of what Don's saying. There is this feeling of this terrible thing that's going on out there that's not really being discussed that much at the top levels.
I met a lot of people involved in Occupy just like that.
Uh-huh.
A lot of women specifically, sort of over 40, 50 maybe, mm-hmm. who said the same thing and weren't really involved in much activism before.
And it's just suddenly, it's such a surprise because you're talking to this person who's, in every way seems totally okay and fine. And not that somebody who says that isn't okay, but it's just a mark of how deep and worried people are and where we're headed.
What are your thoughts about Sensata? This is the Bain-owned manufacturing facility that is set to close in Freeport, Illinois on November 5th and send jobs to China. According to a number of sources, the Institute for Global Labor says that these workers in China are going to earn about 99 cents an hour. So how do you compete with that?
You can't compete with that.
Right.
And what I don't know, because we haven't looked at that specific situation, but we've looked at other Chinese situations. And what the Chinese do at both the national and the provincial level, they provide everything. They sometimes provide the land. They sometimes build the building. We ran across some instances where they actually helped round up the workforce. And, of course, they have no labor laws to speak of and no environmental laws. So you can go into business and do this. And we make the point in the book, okay, a company wants to do that, whoever they are. You're going to bring that product back over here. You need to put a tariff on it. You need to put a tax on it that makes it in some way or another reasonably commensurate with the ability to make that product over here. Because that's not the free market. That's not what free trade is about. Free trade was about trade between nations that had some, you know, equity between them. There's nothing equitable about that, and the Chinese do not practice free trade.
And again, this is a U.S.-owned Sensata. It's a Bain factory,
sure,
of course,
right?
Mitt Romney's Bain Capital. And speaking of uprising, there were uprisings. There were many protests outside of this factory. People did get arrested.
Right.
It didn't get much media. Do you know much about the closed-door trade meetings that are happening currently with the Obama administration?
We do not have any inside information on it, but trade, before agreements are struck, most of those negotiations historically have always been behind closed doors. So you don't know. We're speaking out of turn because we don't know any details on that. But historically, that's what's happened. And then once when they get those things worked out, the thing is presented as a fait accompli, a treaty or whatever it is.
Right.
And then Congress votes or doesn't vote on.
People don't have to look any further than the 30 or 40 year track record on trade. Every single bill, people have been lied to.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, it doesn't matter whether the president was Clinton or Bush or whoever. They have been lied to over and over and over again. We've got 37 consecutive years of trade deficits. That's not an accident. That is a government policy to create the trade deficits. And they've done very well at it. Congress has.
We're speaking with Donald Bartlett and James Steele, authors of the new book, The Betrayal of the American Dream. 20 years ago, they wrote America, What Went Wrong. They have written 8 books together. They've worked together for more than 4 decades. And they are speaking tomorrow night at the Marine Memorial, 609 Sutter at 7 o'clock. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And we've got just over 10 minutes left. We still have full lines. We'll have an open line in just a couple minutes. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And did you want to jump in there, James?
In terms of trade and the issue we just talked about? Or
I thought you just wanted to... I saw you walk. Okay.
I always want to jump in.
You'll jump in just a minute. Okay, let's hear from Steve in San Francisco.
I'll jump in now.
Hi, Steve.
Hi. This is a great show, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to say that, as I recall, during the New Deal of the FDR administration, there was a program called the Unspent Profits Tax, which taxed corporations for not investing their wealth into the economy. And I was wondering if your guests know about that or could comment on that.
All right, and before they do, I just want to mention the tomorrow night's program is at 6 o'clock. 6 o'clock, Marines Memorial Club and Hotel, 609 Sutter at 6 o'clock. Okay, thank you. Go ahead, James.
Very interesting point he raises. This is one that I don't think Don and I are specifically familiar with, but it's totally in keeping with the way the New Deal and actually the Truman administration afterward pursued a lot of these issues. It was a totally different time. Where there was a cap on executive compensation in World War II. Can you imagine that? A cap on executive compensation?
By the government,
by the government. That sounds rather unpatriotic, doesn't it, by American standards today?
And if ever there was a time the pay should be capped at the top, it is now, because it's out of control.
Wait, how did this happen?
Well, it was both legislatively and, I think, administratively back in World War II and thereafter. I mean, now we... When we wrote America, What Went Wrong, the ratio of salaries on the factory floor to, like, corporate executives was about 43 to 1 or something like that. What is it today? It's like 330 to 1
or something. I heard
435.
It goes up every day.
See,
right.
It took us a few minutes to get here.
What was the cap at that point?
There were two things. One is there was a significant high tax on upper income earnings. And in World War II, the top rate was 94%. Now, that wasn't all your income.
Right.
But it was just that last phase of it. But you went up from 30 to 40 to 50 to 60 on up the line. So one of the ways you dealt with that was the tax code. But others had to do, if you had government contracts, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
That there were some limitations on what you could do. You noticed during the Iraq and the Afghanistan war, there were absolutely no limitations from the government side on any of those contracts, let alone just taxing people properly at the upper end if you made $25 or $30 million. So young people in this country have no idea how much more wealthy people used to pay in the United States. Mm-hmm. They have no concept of this. They hear these things about taxes are high. Taxes are not high for wealthy people. In the 50s, in the mid-50s, the richest Americans paid 51% of their income in federal taxes. By 2007, that was down to 16%. And during that same period, taxes on the middle class actually went up. So are taxes high for people at the top? No.
Well, don't you think part of the problem is that the candidates, all they do is talk about tax cuts? Even at the last debate, President Obama talked about cuts. He talked about all the cuts he's given to small businesses.
Absolutely.
So how would you, I guess, sell is the right word, this message on taxes in a one-minute soundbite?
You know, maybe what you have to do is you have to explain to people what taxes do give you and what they may provide. And one of the strongest recommendations we have in the book is we need to invest in the country. Infrastructure is one of the examples. Highways, roads, pipes, high-speed internet networks, technology things we can't even envision. Something not over the next year or two, but
and
over the next 5 to 10 years.
Internet, we didn't get to talk about this last time, and I'll just briefly mention it. But you, and I had no idea, but our speeds are so slow.
Compared to the rest of the world?
No, right. I didn't
And you have all these Americans patting themselves on the back like we're the greatest country in the world. Well, there's a lot of great things in this country. But people are in the dark about how far behind we are in some of these other things.
This is really critical because this comes to that point that Jim had mentioned. We pat ourselves in the back all the time, and we're placing not even the top 10, not even the top 20, longevity. We're not even in the ballpark on longevity. And we tout ourselves as having a world-class healthcare system. We have... There's no way to describe the healthcare system. It is so bad. And it's deliberately so. It doesn't need to be. We've got good people, but the system is totally corrupted.
Well, why don't we take a couple of phone calls, and then we'll get your responses, because I'd like to get as many as we can in the next 5 minutes. Let's hear from Wanda in Berkeley. Hi, Wanda.
Oh, hi. I've been following a story that I've heard a couple of times now about Trans Canada, in Texas, and you know, basically what's happening is our country, our government is colluding with foreign corporations with eminent domain, and they're being given this land that belongs to people, and you know, and those people, or maybe they were rich, but they're, you know, that's really the commons of our country, and it's being sold off to other countries. And I think we need to remember that issue. And one other point is that You're advocating taxation, but, you know, I think the American people, and I am not voting yes on any tax issue, because taxes, unless our government is accountable for our taxes, we should not be taxed. Our taxes need to go for things that are going to help the public, not be taken for war and that kind of thing. So, thank you.
Well, one point on taxes that's really worth bringing up is that most people look at taxes in terms of the total package. It's the federal taxes, it's their Social Security taxes, Medicare. And what's really gone up in this country for an awful lot of average people, working people, are taxes at the state and local level. Those are where so many of the increases have come. So when people talk about taxes, they think of the whole thing. And they very often don't. And most of our thing does talk about the federal level, and it talks about not taxing the middle class anymore, needless to say. But we do talk about upper income brackets. Not just the very richest, but there's a whole range of things that we think additional brackets should be instituted. They would raise more money. They will not take care of all the deficit by any means, but they would make the system more equitable, and they would help reduce some of the deficit. Is this radical? We're only talking about going back a little bit to the way things used to be. So we're not talking about something that hasn't even been tried before. And in an early era, it was quite successful. When people overestimate the impact of taxes at upper income levels, and they forget that when taxes were highest in this country in the 50s and 60s for really wealthy people, strangely enough, that was the period of greatest economic growth. Now, are we saying high taxes necessarily lead to that? We're not saying that. We're just saying taxes get overestimated as an impact on people. But they're very much a part of equity and what kind of a society you do create.
All right, thank you, Wanda. We have an email from Carl. We briefly touched on this last time. He said, I recently heard an interview where the person interviewed said they talked to a hedge fund manager who said that the business class no longer needs an American middle class to consume goods, given the infinite numbers of new Chinese, Indian, and Brazilian consumers. The list goes on. To what extent do your guests think this is true? And if it is, what part of the decline of the middle class do they think it accounts for?
Oh, there's no question about
Donald.
This. Absolutely none at all. One of the hedge fund people from Citicorp coined the word to describe where we are now. It's an old-fashioned plutocracy, but he called it a plutonomy. They gave them their own word. And a government by, of, and for the rich, period. But his thing was the middle class in the United States, because of its shrinking size in no small part, but because of the explosive growth of the middle classes in China, Brazil, India, and other countries, makes the U.S. middle class even if it was the old size, irrelevant. Mm. They can't. They're not in the same ballpark.
The growth is elsewhere. That's the issue.
And this is another reason why we need to institute a new tax system that takes these things into account.
You also quote Robert Benmosch, a CEO of AIG, who says that retirement ages will have to move to 70, 80 years old.
Well, this is the ultimate Ponzi scheme, which if you pay into your pension fund until you're 80, you're dead before you can collect it. This is the ultimate right-wing pension system. What could be better than this?
So we've got about a minute and a half left. In terms of what people can do, have you been following the Walmart strike for the first time in 50 years?
Right. Yeah.
Walmart workers at 20 stores are walking out. I watch this daily. It's just every day something new is happening. There are pockets of things going on across the country.
Right.
What do you think will actually make a difference?
Well, obviously, change occurs very slowly in this country. And people ask us about that. And you think of other areas where things have happened in the past. Usually years lead up to that. So we tell people, do not lose faith. Keep sticking with these issues. Keep trying to raise the consciousness of people. What's interesting about the Walmart workers is you have the conservatives now talking about food stamps. Obama, food stamp president, even though the percentage increase was actually greater under George Bush before him. But the number that nobody mentions is that most of the people with food stamps now work.
Yeah.
They're folks like these people at Walmart. I mean, they're not on welfare.
Right.
It's just because the earnings are so low, they can't support their families.
That's an absolute disgrace. An absolute disgrace in this country. And every corporation should be embarrassed by that.
And so 20 seconds, Donald, what can we do to actually make a difference? I know it's the number one question.
Well, you have to vote. You have to try to vote at least the candidates who might be closest to what might make some changes on this. I mean, that's one of the things you got to do. Keep at it. Be apprised of those developments that may make the difference. This is not going to be easy. It's not going to happen overnight, but I think we all have to keep at it.
I think I rendered Donald speechless.
Yes.
Donald Bartlett and James Steele, their new book is called The Betrayal of the American Dream, and they will be speaking tomorrow night at the Marines Memorial Club and Hotel in San Francisco, 609 Sutter, at 6 o'clock. It's free. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. James and Donald, thank you both for coming in.
Great to be with you, Rose.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you, and thanks for your emails and phone calls, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. Should the death penalty be abolished in California? On the next Your Call, we'll continue our election coverage with a debate on Proposition 34, which would repeal the death penalty and replace it with life imprisonment without parole. Supporters say it will save the state money, while opponents say it's not fair to victims and their family members. Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Do you think it's time to abolish California's death penalty? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihei Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.